It's Good Friday, April the 2nd. You're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to the governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. And this is not the only podcast in town when it comes to the Hoover Institution. We have all sorts of good stuff for you to listen to. There's Egon Talk with Russ Roberts, The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, The Pacific Century with Misha Oslin and John Yu, Goodfellows with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. I tout that one because I'm involved in that one too as the moderator. This is the audio version of the video that we do each week called Goodfellows. There's also The Libertarian with Richard Epstein and Law Talk with Richard Epstein and John Yu. If you want to subscribe to any or all of these podcasts, very simple. Go to the Hoover Institution's website, which is www.hoover.org. Click on the Publications tab. Go to where it says Podcasts, and you can subscribe to any or all. You can also sign up for our monthly Pod Blast, as we call it, which sends the best of our podcast each month to you. Hoover Podcast, just one part of ideas defining a free society. My guest joining me today from sunny, I assume, Southern California is my colleague Leo Hanian. Leo is a Hoover Institution senior fellow and a professor of economics and director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at UCLA. He's also associate director of the Center for Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative Macroeconomics Across Time and Space. Lee, great to have you on the podcast. It's been way too long.
Bill, good to see you. It has been way too long.
Okay, let's get to the pressing business. UCLA basketball. Back in full glory. Did you think you would live to see the day?
Yeah, you know, a classic Cinderella story, because they certainly weren't. They were, you know, by far a dark horse, 11th seed. And yeah, they're just the little team that could. And then they are a little team. They often, for basketball aficionados out there, they kind of run a four guard, one forward offense. And I think the good times will end Saturday against Gonzaga. I don't think they have much of a chance, but, you know, crazier things have happened. But good news for the Pac-12 conference. UCLA, along with USC and Oregon State, all were in the tourney. They've earned the conference so far about $38 million, perhaps to continue to grow, depending on what happens. Couldn't have come at a better time when California is struggling so much fiscally. So yeah, go Bruins.
It is. And there's something very kind of California comfort food about this, Lee. I'm about to seriously age myself, but I grew up at a time when we didn't have ESPN and we didn't have much in the way of college sports exposure. I lived in the East Coast in Washington, D.C., so I rarely saw UCLA play basketball, but every March you would see them play and the Final Four win the championship with Jabbar and Bill Walton. So, you know, seeing those uniforms this deep in the tournament, there's something very nostalgic about it, I find.
Yeah, it definitely is back in the day. It brings back a lot of history, and I'll date myself as well. No, I remember life before ESPN and the ability to watch any one of 30 basketball games that might be on at the same time. So yes, the uniforms are pretty much the same. John Wooden, the Wizard of Westwood, is gone, but UCLA's new coach, a fellow they hired out of Cincinnati, Mick Cronin, who had a, you know, rough first year and a somewhat rough second year this year, but they're taking off and they're taking off in the tournament, and they're going to try to go to the Final Four. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, one thing people don't understand about California, true of a lot of states, Lee, is that the UCLA basketball coach, UCLA football coach, these are, if not the highest paid, one of the highest paid public employees in the state of California.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, the type of salaries the best basketball and football coaches earn at UCLA, and almost certainly at Berkeley as well, are in the $4 to $5 million range. And that would never pass muster with Sacramento. So what these schools have to do is they really have to find deep pocket alumni who are willing to top things off. But they're, they want to see winning sports teams. And UCLA basketball has come through. UCLA football is looking to be, as they sadly, they have the worst record in the Power Five in the last 3 years. When they hired Chip Kelly, former, idiot savant offensive mind from Oregon from a few years ago, but that the bloom may be off Chip's rose. So anyway, Bruin basketball good, Bruin football not so good, and we'll see what happens this weekend.
And let's talk about the California economy, Lee, which falls somewhere in between. So as this is beginning of April, the state has just crunched data for the month of February. And here's what we found. In February, Lee, the California economy gained 141,000 non-farm payroll jobs. This is according to the state's Employment Development Department, EDD, which you've written about for other reasons. The employment rate in the Golden State fell 0.5 percentage points to 8.5% in February, Lee, compared with 6.2% in the U.S. Now, let's contrast that a little bit. In February of 2020, before the pandemic struck in full force in California, unemployment, Lee, was 4.3%. This comes at a time when the Anderson School put out its forecast. I could tell you from having worked for a governor in my past life, we always waited with bated breath for what the UCLA Anderson School said about the economy. Here's what they wrote earlier this month, Lee, quote, a waning pandemic combined with fiscal relief means a strong year of growth in 2021, one of the strongest years of growth in the last 60 years, followed by sustained higher growth rates in 2022 and 2023. Do you agree?
Maybe. not to duck the question or my colleagues in the Anderson B School, but let me put down a little bit of context. Go back to last summer when many of the restrictions that were impacting state economies because of COVID were lifted. I believe the third quarter U.S. growth rate was 36% on an annualized basis. That's just off the charts. We've never seen anything like that. And that is really good news for really two reasons, because it demonstrates just how resilient the U.S. economy is, despite right. the varied and draconian regulations, restrictions, really. This was a government-mandated depression, intended to either stop, which never came true, a virus, or at least slow the virus down so that hospital emergency rooms wouldn't become inundated and people would have to be treated out in the streets. Go back 10 years ago, and at the time, President Obama's first term, and you know, the unemployment rate was just budgingly slow. Month after month, 9%, 8.9%, 8.9%. The unemployment rate just wouldn't come down. And there were some economists, and certainly President Obama's administration would say, well, you know, if you have a severe recession, you just don't come out of it very quickly. It takes years to recover. Almost all of my research goes against that view. My research says a healthy economy will recover incredibly fast, provided the right policies are in place. We showed how fast the U.S. economy could recover if reasonable policies were in place last summer. The idea that an economy won't recover quickly is just hogwash. So getting back to what we're going to be looking at California, yes, as we lift restrictions, automatically that spring pops back. Is it going to pop back to 4% unemployment? I don't think so, because state and local policies continue to be put in place that are depressing economic activity. Right. So, for example, a lot of the growth we had in California the last few years occurred without AB 5. AB 5, Assembly Bill 5, makes it illegal for a lot of individuals to work as independent contractors. Completely silly law. I should use a different adjective than silly, because there's a lot of people in the state who've had their livelihoods destroyed by making it illegal for them to work as independent contractors.
They're largely rideshare people, right?
Yeah. Well, certainly a lot of it is gig workers, but you know, there are people such as if you are a tow truck operator and you're affiliated with AAA. Right. You get to be an independent contractor. If you're right. a tow truck operator, you're not affiliated with AAA, guess what? You can't be an independent contractor. So we see those types of policies coming down the pike, which impact the ability of people to create economic activity, because creating economic activity becomes more and more expensive to do. The more expensive you make something, the less of it you get. So yeah, California, like all states, should be springing back. But Bill, keep in mind, California's unemployment rate for the last few months has been the worst in the country, except for Nevada and Hawaii. Right. What's special about Nevada and Hawaii? a ton of their economic activity comes from hospitality and leisure and travel. Mm-hmm. California is second only to those places. So people should understand there's been something very, very wrong with California. If we're number 48 in terms of the unemployment rate, and by the way, the national unemployment rate is now down to what, 6 or 6.2%?
6.2, yeah.
That's roughly the average unemployment rate for the last 60 or 70 years. Mm-hmm. This is, from the standpoint of unemployment, this is no longer a recession. There are still many people who are kept out of work because of the government mandated shutdown. And unemployment, I suspect, nationally should fall down to about 5. But this is no longer a severe recession by any means. But in California, we're still over 8%. So that's an indication that deep down, California has problems. That you and I have been harping on this for now years since we've been doing California on your mind. We keep wanting state and local politicians to wake up and look out there and see how many people are struggling and see how expensive it is to live here and do business here, and watch as Elon Musk thumbs his nose at us and moves to Texas and takes his ball with him, known as Tesla, and his HP moves, and his Oracle moves, and his Charles Schwab moves. And we hope sooner rather than later that politicians wake up and says, we have to be competitive. And just getting back, Bill, getting back to your basketball analogy, I think Musk, I'm going to paraphrase him, something like, California is like an NBA team that's used to being on top, but they haven't won a championship in many years, and they still think they're that good, but they really aren't.
You know who it is? It's the Las Vegas now Raiders. The Raiders have been floating on an idea, the greatness of the Raiders, as the late Al Davis called it, when the fact is they had not won a Super Bowl since the 1980s. So California's maybe saying, I'm glad you mentioned the Elon Musk and leaving California, because that is one question that puzzles me, Lee, and that's the idea of how you put the toothpaste back in the tube. We've seen state data which shows the population, California's population, declining for the first time in the recorded history of this state. You're going to see a big to-do very soon about redistricting in California, because a congressional seat's going to be taken away. It could be Mike Garcia, the new Republican from Los Angeles County. It could be Daryl Issa, the return congressman from San Diego. But we're going to lose for the first time a congressional seat. But, you know, it's interesting, Lee, when you look at people leaving California, there is evidence that, by the way, the U.S. Postal Service, Lee, which keeps account of out-of-state address changes since 2018 for California, out-of-state address changes in California, Lee, have more than doubled to 211,000. So people are leaving. They're headed elsewhere.
People are leaving. Right? Yeah, people are leaving. And it's, in some ways, it's easier to leave than ever now, ironically brought about by the pandemic, because, you know, an important aspect of the U.S. economy is that economic activity is very fluid, businesses adapt, people adapt. And we now know that somebody can live in Park City, Utah, and for the most part, you know, be hired by a business in Silicon Valley and make 4 or 6 trips out there per year, but otherwise work in their man cave in the basement, or their woman cave in the basement. So California has to be more worried than ever about this. And Bill, again, going back to the idea about what should policymakers be thinking about every morning when they get up, they should be thinking about, why are we losing people? Well, it's one of these Kel Surprise types of things. The median home price, so I recently calculated based on California Association of Realtor data, I calculated a weighted average of median home prices in coastal California, meaning San Diego County, Orange County, LA County, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County. You kind of work your way up to about Sonoma County. That median home price is $1.3
million.
$1.3 million. Conforming mortgage at that level would be 20%. So $260,000 down payment. I think off the top of my head, the qualifying income for that home would be something like $220,000 household income. How many people can deliver those two items to be able to buy a single family home, which a lot of people want if they have kids. So, you know, Kel Surprise people are leaving and going to Park City, Utah, or going to Austin, Texas, or going to all sorts of places where it doesn't cost $1.3 million and you don't need $260,000 for a down payment to buy a 2,000 square foot house on a 6,000 square foot lot that probably needs some fixing up anyway.
Yeah. So Lee, the housing issue was there before the pandemic. I mean, that's been a chronic problem. There's been a problem since I've been in the state since 1994. You go back further than California, but it's always been you move to California, expect the housing hit. But I think what stands out about the last year, Lee, is you've seen two other things come into play when it comes to the outward migration. Number one is work. You now, thanks to the virtual workplace, you don't have to be, physically in your office. You don't have to be within commuting distance of your work in California. You and I could be having this conversation anywhere else in the country right now, other than California. So that's given the green light for people to get out of the state. And I think the other issue, Lee, would be education. And then if you look how other states have handled school reopenings versus California, California is badly behind the curve. I think California was, at one point dead last in terms of percentage schools open at one point. It's if you're raising your kids, I mean, there are two issues here. One is how to get your kids a quality education, which ties in a lot of other issues about indoctrination, which is probably another podcast for another day, but just the idea of your schools being run the way you want. So I think people take those three factors into the cost of housing, the quality of education, and their work lifestyle now. And yeah, you can bug out of California.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So you're looking at a person or a family making a decision about where to locate, and they look at the $1.3 million house, and they look at the the $250,000 down payment, and then they look at the fact that they might have to send their two kids to private school, which may have tuition of $20,000 per kid, $25,000 per kid. I'm a private school parent, and my wife and I are shelling out $36,000 for our eighth grader pre-tax, and that's a huge hit. You hit something very, very important, which is school reopenings. Yes, California was dead last, and interestingly, when Biden was inaugurated, January 9th, I can't remember the exact date, but Newsom wrote him a letter on that date, pledging his allegiance and saying, we'll do anything we can to support you and California's willing partner, and right, all of our wonderful progressive ideas are modeled for the rest of the state, yada, yada, yada. So what happens? Biden talks about the importance of getting kids back into school. 100% of the research shows that kids are just being devastated by this. I mean, I'm the parent of a 14-year-old. He has been in school. He's been in person school, thankfully, since October. But before that, I saw the toll it was taken on him. And a lot of most other kids in California have been out of school for over a year. So Biden wants to get kids back in school. What can Newsom do to really move the needle for Biden? Get kids back into school. Newsom, is he able to get kids back into school? No, he isn't. He has a recalcitrant set of teachers unions who will just not say yes. And a governor who is politically weakened, maybe we'll get into this a little bit later, but Gavin had roughly a 67% approval rating last fall. Mm-hmm. By February, it was down to roughly 47%. Very politically weakened governor threw out some carrots to teachers, to districts and teachers unions, saying, hey, here's what we'll do to protect you and be able to make sure you feel comfortable coming back to school. Hybrid model, sure, that's on the table. Nope. California Teachers Association, which is the largest teachers union in the state, wrote a letter to Newsom outlining essentially their demands, which not only included all teachers must be vaccinated before they're willing to come back, but that the CTA was essentially going to take on the important public health administrative responsibility of figuring out who else would be prioritized to get vaccinations, including people within teachers' families and staff members, and people in staff members' families, and extended families. So suddenly we have teachers unions. I don't think there's a whole lot of epidemiologists or public health specialists or virologists in those unions, right, wanting to make administrative public health decisions, almost comical. And and who's suffering? Primarily really, really poor families where both parents have to work and kids don't have computers and kids don't have access to tutors. And without a computer, they can't go to Khan Academy or other types of learning websites online. It's been a complete disaster. And Bill, I'll stop it here because I've been yakking here for a few minutes. I think the silver lining here is that parents are starting to see that the teacher of their children that they absolutely adore is not the teacher's union. The teacher's right. union and the teacher that they love are two very, very different people and or organizations.
Yeah.
So and I hope this starts to, I hope that teachers unions have been very effective at trying to duck and push off responsibilities of deficiencies in learning in this state for which they're responsible for. I don't know if they're going to be able to continue to do that, or at least so effectively.
Yeah, but you know, like Housing Lee, here's another situation, a policy area for California that's been exasperated by the pandemic. Remember, there was a walkout in Los Angeles Unified School District before the pandemic. UTLA, Unified Teachers Los Angeles, struck. They walked out in the middle of school year. This, once upon a time, this was considered an act of heresy. Teachers did not abandon their schools during the middle of school year, but the teachers in Los Angeles walked out. They also went on strike in Oakland. And what do they want in Los Angeles, Lee? They wanted more money, obviously. They wanted more money for the classroom. But Lee, they also wanted Medicare for all. And they also wanted a wealth tax imposed upon California. This was sort of a strike led by Bernie Sanders, if you will. So it was a strike that in large part did not directly apply to education. So that mentality has been there. And it's just, you know, it's I think in terms of the teacher support, maybe I overread these things, but if you go back to last November's election in California, Lee, there was a fascinating disconnect. Joe Biden wins the state by an enormous margin, gets the most votes ever for a Democrat in California. Donald Trump is hard-pressed to get to close to 35%. So that would seem to create a tailwind effect for any and all ballot measures downwind. In other words, a Democrat wins big at the top. Just if you have a liberal idea, it's going to just like a bicycle draft behind the truck going down the highway. But what you saw, Lee, was that two measures in particular failed. Well, actually, first of all, you mentioned Prop 8. So the ballot measure to amend Prop 8 actually passed widely in a very expensive fight. But two measures that struck me as a bit of a surprise here. There was a ballot measure, Lee, that attempted to undo Proposition 209. This was a message from the 1990s, 1996, which makes admissions at public universities no racial quotas, it's colorblind, and that failed. That failed by a pretty wide margin. But the real surprise, the real shocker, Lee, was an attempt by the left, in part by CTA, the California Teachers Association, to change Proposition 13 and take the property tax side of that and update it and take all that money and, you know, there'd be a big carve out for education. And here's what was interesting about that, Lee. It was a very, very kind of paint by the numbers campaign. There's a formula to winning in California, Democrats have discovered. You put your idea up and you trot out firemen and nurses and teachers, people who wear the white hats in society. And so you saw ads for this measure around the state featuring mostly teachers saying what a wonderful thing this will be for education in California. The measure bombed, Lee. It did not pass despite having Joe Biden at the top of the ticket. So I kind of wonder if before the pandemic, maybe there were already cracks, fissures, if you will, in the foundation here. The people were starting to look at education in California and thinking, you know, what are we getting for our money? And, you know, do you want to just throw more money at the situation? Or maybe it's time to take an examination. Now, sadly, I don't see anybody in Sacramento who wants to take on this examination. You're right. The teachers unions have absolute control over the place. They control lawmakers. They have the governor's ear, if not his wallet as well. And this does lead us to the question of the recall. Let's talk recall politics for a few minutes. So we're kind of in a lull right now. So March 17th was the deadline for handing in signatures, Lee, reportedly 2.1 million. If you do the math on this, my crude mathematical skills, I'm not a talented economist like you, so my math is not as good as you, but The certification rate for these things is about 5 out of 6, a little over 81-82%. So my math tells me that they're going to finish ahead of the 1.5 million signature threshold they need to trigger this thing. This is based on state law, which says that you have to collect enough signatures commensurate with 12% of the vote in the previous gubernatorial election. We will know that count by April the 29th, Lee, and then a whole bunch of fun kicks in. It's not like we'll have a vote a couple days later. There's a 30-day window where if Lee Ohanian has signed a recall petition, Lee Ohanian can pull it back if he wants to. This is a provision the Democrats put in after a recall attempt of a state senator in 2018. So it's a 30-day window for that, Lee. There's another 30-day window in there to look at the cost of this. I don't know why it takes 30 days to figure out the cost. There's 30 days built into that. There's some horsing around the Secretary of State's office and legislature. Bottom line, Lee, is if it does qualify, then the lieutenant governor has to call an election within 60 to 80 days after she, Lady Kunalakis, calls it. So maybe October, maybe November. Here's the question for you, Lee. What policy should we be talking about in the recall? I worry that this is going to become largely personality driven, as in 2003, when Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in the race. And yeah, Arnold was talking about the car tax, and he was talking about blowing off the boxes in Sacramento. But it was largely theatrical because it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is kind of a kind of entertainment, if you will. I worry, Lee, that the recall effort with Newsom is going to be largely personality based. It's going to be that, you know, I just don't like this guy. French Laundry. Look at his hair. He just oozes a Marin County entitlement, when as there are a lot of serious problems with California. So this is a very long-winded way, Lee, of getting to this question, which is if you were running this recall, let's say that you had the ability to run a debate with Newsom and two or three, you know, prominent people running against him, and you were in charge of the debate, Lee, and you could ask questions to these candidates. Let's talk about three or four topics you'd like to bring up.
So yeah, the you know, California, cost of living in California is 50% higher than the median. And 38% of Californians live either below the, either at or below the poverty line or within spitting distance of the poverty line. And that's just unacceptable. So that cost of living is really driven by housing. So housing has to be on that list of four questions. Improving school performance, K through 12, has to be on that list of questions. Creating a sustainable budget. Right now, we're on a path of unsustainability because pensions are going to become more and more expensive. Right now, they're two-thirds of the budget goes to K through 12, the prison system, health and human services, and pensions. Two-thirds of the budget. How do we run the rest of the people budget and deliver quality would be number three on that list. And how you improve California's competitiveness within the business sphere. So every survey of CEOs, every study done by nonpartisan foundations, such as the Tax Foundation, such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has California listed 48th, 49th in terms of business friendliness. So those would be the four: housing, education, budget and taxes, and business climate. Those would be the four I would want to talk to the candidates about. And when I look at Gavin, he hasn't delivered on any of those. Now, granted, we've been in a pandemic since March of 2020. But before then, there was roughly 14 months where Gavin was in place and he had a honeymoon period. And he had lots of big ideas, such as a Marshall Plan for housing and and equity and equality for California kids with better educations. And the list went on. And the needle didn't move on any of those. So I think Gavin's not going to look particularly good when it comes to evaluating where we are now and where we might be going. because he had big plans and nothing happened. So I think voters are going to say, well, you know, if you couldn't get anything done the first 14 months when you had your honeymoon period, why should we think you're going to get anything done now? And I know, Bill, I'm trying to remember, were there what, like 30 characters on the recall ballot last time with Arnold and Gray Davis? And of course, most of those got very few in the way of votes, but it really created kind of a circus-like environment. Do you think that's going to happen this time? Because I agree with you, the recall is coming.
Yeah, there are 135 candidates on the ballot, Lee. And here's why. If you're eligible to be governor of California, and here's a scary thought for you today, Lee. If you look at the state rules, I actually dug this up the other day. Most states, Lee, the cutoff age for being a governor, or at least the threshold age, it's 30, which makes sense. It's 25 for the House of Representatives. I think 30 is the Senate cutoff minimum as well. President's 35, but 30 for a governor. You know what it is in California, Lee? 18. Any 18-year-old in California, Lee, who can either gather 7,000 signatures or just chip and send $4,000 to the state. And, you know, one of the dirty secrets of California is just a lot of loose cash floating around there. Kids, the kids have resources, and if they don't spend $4,000 on a watch, they can send $4,000. This seems to me to be just a real devil's playground, Lee, for a lot of just kind of silly TikTok and Instagram and Yahoo or YouTube influencers just get on the ballot for a month. But you asked how many people will run. So here's, let's get a little game within the game. The lieutenant governor is tasked with deciding when the election is, which means that she will talk to the governor's people and decide when they want it. You can argue that maybe if Newsom feels good about the way things are going in the state and his own fortunes, he'll want it sooner rather than later. Why? Just the longer it waits, the more chance for something to go wrong. Now, here's what she could do to really make things interesting. She could declare a recall election 60 days from the moment she calls it. Why is that interesting? Because, Lee, you can only get into a recall election 59 days out. That's the cutoff date for getting in. If she announced a 60 days ahead for the recall, that would give people in California one day to figure out what they're doing. And if you go back to 2003, there was a chess game going on between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Richard Reardon, the former mayor of Los Angeles, and Dianne Feinstein, all kind of looking at each other and deciding who's going to run. And Arnold, I think he kind of tricked Dick Reardon here. That's for them to figure out. But he basically waited out Feinstein, and then he jumped in. So if she, Eleni Kounoulakis, calls a 60-day election, you're going to have a lot of people flying around all trying to figure out. We know at least three Republicans are running. That's Kevin Faulkner, the former mayor of San Diego, John Cox, who ran against Newsom in 2018, and Doug Ossie is a former congressman from Sacramento, Richard Grenell, who was an ambassador to Germany under Trump and at one time as director of national intelligence. He's making noise about running. So that's maybe four Republicans. And this is a problem if you want to oust Gavin Newsom. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Tom McClintock were on the Republican side in 2003. Together, they amassed about 62% of the vote. Remember, recall is a two-question ballot. It's question one, recall the governor, yes or no. Then question two, Which of these yutzes do you choose to be the next governor of California? And together, Schwarzenegger and McClintock got about 62% of the vote, with Arnold getting over 48% of it. That was back, Lee, when Republicans had 35% of the electorate in California, registered voters. But also an election, Lee, if you look at the exit polls from 2003, Republican turnout was huge in that election, and Democrats were kind of depressed. They didn't want to rally to Gray Davis for some reason. They just weren't enthusiastic about him. If you look at the exit polls from the 2003 recall, Lee, Republican turnout and Democratic turnout was just about equal. That's not going to happen in 2020 California, 2021 California, because why? Democrats, who were about 10% more in numbers in 2003, Lee, are over 20% more. And Newsom, unlike Davis, is already fighting this. I signed up for everybody's emails. I've had about a half a dozen from Gavin Newsom's campaign in the last week, just asking for money. That's just telling me that they're taking this seriously. So you look at that, and it's hard to see Newsom getting recalled just based on the numbers. But in terms of the turnout, you could have 135 people, Lee, but there's not going to be one Arnold Schwarzenegger. There's not going to be one person who just kind of controls the narrative as Arnold did, which means that really it'll be Newsom in control of his political fate. Now, maybe he survives the recall vote. On the other hand, people are not happy with him. You mentioned the sagging poll numbers. People are not happy at the way things have gone in the past year. They might want to take a pound of flesh. And for some people, he's a rather enticing and rather inviting target. I'll tell you a funny story. It's a telling story, I think. My old boss, Pete Wilson, had a conversation with Governor Newsom before Newsom took office. Newsom did what governors do. He made the rounds. He called the former governors and said, you know, what's your advice? And Wilson's advice was, you have to remember, you're governing one state, but it's really about eight states rolled into one. So just remember this. And I think by some people's estimations, Lee Gavin Newsom is guilty of one crime, which is he's kind of governed as the governor of Marin County. And, you know, you look in the Central Valley, you look at the Inland Empire, you look at the big empty up north. This is a governor who doesn't necessarily share your values and doesn't seem to share your concerns on economy and education. So that could come to bite him, but it's hard to see him. It's hard to see him winning in this, losing in this environment right now. It's just his numbers aren't as bad as Gray Davis's, and there's just not a Schwarzenegger putting along. But look, I was wrong every step of the way about Donald Trump from the beginning when he got into politics to the end. You pretty much named the moment, and I would have gotten it wrong. So if I had to bet your money, I'd probably bet that Newsom survives this thing. But, you know, I could be wrong again, Lee.
Yeah, it's a tough call, Bill. So a couple of observations and one comparison between Gray Davis in 03 and Newsom now. If I look back to 03 and if I ask myself, was Gray, irrespective of his mishandling of the electricity crisis, which is really what led to Davis being recalled at that time. Irrespective of that one data point, Gray Davis, in my opinion, I don't think was meant to be the governor of California. He was an okay politician. I don't think he was a good enough politician to be a leader. And what you said is so important about you're governing eight different states. California's 40 million people. You know, it's within spitting distance of the size of France. Is Gavin Newsom as good of a leader as Emmanuel Macron, who's really struggling to try to keep France together? No, I don't think he's anywhere close to being as good of a leader as Emmanuel Macron. Putting aside any kind of partisan issues, just thinking about from the standpoint, is the person a powerful enough personality and listener and has ideas that can bring a whole different group of people together? I don't think Gavin is anywhere close to that. I don't think Gavin was able to do that within San Francisco. Gavin has been riding coattails of a political machine for years. And I hate to say this, but as a really good looking guy, I think that may be as responsible for all the votes he gets as anything else, because I don't believe he is qualified to govern a state of 40 million people, where those people range within even in his own party, from Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook down to tens of thousands of people who are barely making, barely paying the rent, and who, if they have an unexpected auto repair, are gonna, you know, are gonna be behind on the rent. So it's a really difficult job. And there aren't a whole lot of people, independent of partisanship, who would be able to be an effective leader. What I mean by effective leader is foster consensus and create bipartisan solutions and make California a better place, reduce the cost of housing, improve K through 12 education, have a feasible budget, make California more attractive as a source of business. Outside of the tech industry, which very fortuitously has an enormous base of venture capital, which makes that so easy, but that's been around for decades. That's not because of Gavin or any other single governor. So okay, so what will happen with the recall? I think chances are we may be left with Gavin, but on the other hand, you know what. Economists look at voting as, you know, who is the average voter within the electorate? Mm-hmm. And in California, the average voter has become a Hispanic family with kids who is much more conservative than the progressive wing of the state's Democratic Party, who is concerned about school quality, who is concerned about being able to buy a home, who is much more attached to the labor force than other demographic groups, is much more entrepreneurial, who really worries about the cost of doing business. You look at those folks, you look at Asian American demographics who really got behind and defeated and supported the initiative to prevent going back to racial and gender-based preferences in education and hiring. I think California's median voter is nowhere close to what Gavin Newsom has been standing for. Donald Trump, you know, whether people like him or not, incredibly damaged Republican Party within California. And people, a lot of people voted for Democrats because I think they just were fed up with Trump and didn't see a healthy alternative and wanted to say, I'm going to speak out. But Trump is gone now. So I look at a person like, say, Kevin Falconer, in my opinion, did a good job in San Diego. Housing costs in San Diego are much less than anywhere, than most other places in coastal California. Their economy is doing well. He put in reasonable climate initiatives. He's a smart guy. He's a reasonable guy. He understands at the end of the day what people want. They want good schools. They want affordable housing. Right. They want to have, they want to be able to be free to do what they want. They don't want to have something like AB5 and not be told that they can't be an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned about timing is really interesting, because the longer it goes, you know, the longer the memory of Trump fades. So I think the sooner the election is called, I think the better it is for the Democratic Party. But thinking ahead, at the end of the day, you know, in another 2 years, we're going to be looking at if Gavin survives the recall, he'll be an incredibly weakened political animal, mm-hmm. who, you know, again, won't deliver. The economy is going to bounce back from COVID, not because of Gavin. It'll just bounce back because economy's bounced back. But if he survives the recall, he'll end up in
He's up in 2022.
2022. Okay, a year later, he won't have gotten anything done. So the plus sign is, will Gavin change? Will Gavin be willing to be governor of anything other than Gavin? He's the governor of Gavin. During the pandemic, even Democrats were upset with them for not bringing them into the fold and making decisions. So can he change? Will he change? He's going to be a politically damaged animal, in my opinion, even if he survives this.
Democrats in California are not one happy family, Lee. There are Democrats who behind the scenes really would like to see this governor go. I know some of them. They are close to Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles. They would like to see him run. You mentioned Latinos. If you look at Newsom's poll numbers, this is one of the reasons why he's in trouble right now. His Latino numbers have sunk. I suspect as a result of the pandemic, which is a combination of available jobs or unavailable jobs and education. If you are Hispanic in California and you don't have a lot of money, you obviously need to work. You can't rely on your savings for very long. And you need education, Lee, because that's childcare for you every day. So this is turning on his head. And if you go back to the recall in 2003, you look at Davis's numbers. He had been reelected to a second term the previous year, Lee, but it was a pretty unspectacular reelection. He won by only about 4 points, I think, less than 4 points. His numbers fell off with Latinos in the recall election. Now, part of that was Arnold, because Arnold's strongest demographic for moviegoers was ironically young Hispanic males. But anyway, there's a parallel there. Let's talk a bit about a couple other things. So one thing, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post recently, Lee, in which I talked about what I called the Wile E. Coyote scenario for the recall. And that is that you succeed in recalling Newsom, but now you go to the second question of the ballot and who's the next governor. And this is the Wile E. Coyote scenario. Wile E. Coyote, in that you set up an elaborate trap, and the moment you put the match to the dynamite, it blows up in your face. What could happen here is a Democrat could be on the ballot. Now, the governors, people would love to have no Democrats on the other side, but that's nuts. You need insurance. You've got to have a governor have a Democrat on the second question, Lee, just in case the unforeseen happens. Here's a scenario I painted. One Democrat shows up on the second side of the ballot versus 3, 4, 5 Republicans. That Democrat, just based on the numbers in California, becomes the next governor. And that Democrat, Lee, is Lorena Gonzalez. the author of AB5, which we've been talking about. In other words, the premise is this: you succeed, you win the battle in getting rid of Gavin Newsom, but you lose the war, Lee, because now for the next year, because that governor would serve out the rest of Newsom's term through 2022, you would have 1 year in Sacramento, Lee, where it'd be Mr. Toad's wild ride, where if you thought Newsom was progressive, just wait until someone like Lorena Gonzalez or Ro Khanna, the congressman from close to me in the South Bay and in San Jose, who's a big Bernie Sanders acolyte, you get a seriously progressive socialist governor in California. And whereas historically, Lee, the governor is something of a bulwark against the legislature, now you have a governor who's willing to work hand in hand on matters like wealth tax, on all sorts of, you know, changing social covenants. So this is where the recall becomes troublesome, and that you could make a bad situation worse by having that happen.
Yeah, it is a frightening scenario.
And I was scared you on Good Friday.
I think, I was going to say somewhere it's 5 o'clock, isn't it? Somewhere it's happy hour. You're gonna chase me out to the local liquor store.
Let's shift into the more comical and the more surreal, and shooting fish in a barrel, if you will. And let's talk about San Francisco, because, you know, when we talk about Gavin Newsom, Lee, I think it's important to point out to listeners that this is kind of politics 2.0, if you will, for San Francisco. I just wrote a column for California Under Mind, noting that Willie Brown, the former assembly speaker, the Ayatollah of the assembly, he was a speaker for 20 years before term limits kicked in Sacramento. He turned 87 last month. That's the same age as Dianne Feinstein, a former mayor of San Francisco, like Willie Brown as well. But then you have Newsom and a younger generation who they have a different outlook on the world. Feinstein is known as what? A common grounds person, somebody who first made a mark on California politics, Lee, by going to a Democratic convention and telling them that they were out of touch with the voters on the death penalty. Willie Brown cut deals left and right as an assemblymaker. He's not really a real belief Democrat, if you will. But Newsom's different. But I think you're starting to see a shift here in San Francisco as well. And that has to do with a fellow named Chase Oboden. And we were talking about this before we came on the air. There is a slogan going around San Francisco right now. And that slogan, Lee, is VC Lives Matter. That's VC, not Viet Cong. That's VC as in venture capitalist. Here's what's going on. Chase Oboden is the district attorney for the city/county of San Francisco. To say he is soft on crime would be an understatement. Silicon Valley now has become aware of this, Lee, because what? This is a quality of life issue if you're running a tech company in San Francisco. But here's what I don't understand. Maybe you can explain the dichotomy here. At the same time that you have tech people trying to drive Chase Oboden out of a job, just last week, Lee, we had the likes of Lorena Powell Jobs, she's Steve Jobs' widow, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, Sean Parker from the social network at Napster fame, early Facebook investor, Marissa Meyer, formerly of Yahoo, who's kind of the Gavin Newsom, I think, of high tech, if you will. They came out very publicly in support of the governor. So on the one hand, Silicon Valley loves the governor, but Silicon Valley seems to hate the DA. So Can you make sense of this?
I think that's showing growing fissures within the state's Democratic Party, and in more particularly, tech is concentrated in Silicon Valley, and then also in San Francisco. And San Francisco, even for the uber wealthy, is becoming an embarrassment that one can no longer avoid. The drug problem within San Francisco is devastating everyone within the city. There are 535, as far as we know, 535 drug addicts per city block within the city. There are more drug abusers within San Francisco than there are high school children. So think about that for a moment. Nearly three times as many people in San Francisco died of opioid overdoses than of COVID. So talk about public health epidemics, three times as many opioid overdose deaths than COVID. Many parts of the city have become, because of the San Francisco DA, have become quasi-legal open-air drug bazaars. You have people using needles and passed out everywhere. And children are seeing this every day. It's you can't ride a BART train and not be hit by this. San Francisco is paying, for lack of a better word, pooper scoopers, $190,000 per year, including benefits, to clean up human feces off of sidewalks. The San Francisco was a city budget of $15,000 per resident. Nowhere in the country is there anything close to that. Manhattan, New York, under Bill de Blasio, has a city budget of about $11,000, and nothing else comes close. And yet the city has a fiscal crisis. San Francisco just needs to be pulled up by its bootstraps, and crime is such an enormous problem, interlinked with drug abuse, and Chase will not prosecute drug sellers, even though they are now selling fentanyl, a synthetic opioid coming in from China, in which just a couple of grams can be fatal. Paramedics who go to an emergency situation where someone has a fentanyl overdose, they have to wear hazmat suits. Otherwise, they might inhale fentanyl, and it's very easy to get a toxic dose. So San Francisco, which is home to a lot of tech, VC Lives Matter, it's almost become to the point of comic book.
You mentioned fiscal crisis, Lee, but they're getting about $660 million, $1 billion, I think, from the federal government, aren't they? Or $660 million, I think.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it couldn't come
COVID stimulus money.
Yeah. It couldn't come at a better time, or what I would say, a worse time. A better time because they have a fiscal crisis. A worse time is because nowhere in the country, I might say nowhere in the world, right, does any city burn up dollars like San Francisco? Right now, San Francisco is housing the homeless, some homeless, in tents, in parking lots within the city, at a cost of $61,000 per year. Spending $61,000 per year to house people in tents. Where does that money go? They are paying about $360,000 per year for what are called pit stops, semi-permanent public restrooms. So, Bill, that $660 million may not go very far. This will be just kind of a temporary sugar high for them. So, you know, good for Silicon Valley in demanding that there be some, you know, just a modicum of reasonable governance within a city that seems to have just gone completely off the rails. But for a long time, Silicon Valley's had a good longstanding relationship with Gammon. He has, he's kind of taking care of them, and I don't think they're willing really to take a chance with what the alternative might be. So there you have it. Down on Chase, up for Gavin.
It's not just San Francisco that has money coming in, Lee. The state government is awash in money. This is a contradiction. While you have this, California's economy is just slowly moving back. Sacramento cannot be more flush than money. It already has a surplus of $14 or $15 billion for the current year, just based on strong capital gains and just the economy not being as devastated as we thought. But now, thanks to the stimulus package, there's another $26 billion rolling in, Lee. So now the state has $40 billion to play with. This is what I'm writing about for the next California on your mind. So what comes into play here now is something called the GAN limit, which, for those who are not familiar, Paul GAN is a very colorful, unsung hero in California politics, if you will. Paul GAN was a co-author of Proposition 13 with Howard Jarvis, but GAN was rather kind of shy and retiring, a very interesting background coming from Arkansas, I believe, whereas Jarvis was, be polite about it, he was a loudmouth, he was a showman, and up on the cover of Time magazine after Prop 13 passes. GAN in 1979, Lee, puts forward a measure called Proposition 4, and Proposition 4 is a limit on revenue in California. And what it says is if revenue gets over X amount of money, it has to get kicked back to the people. And this has happened only once before in California. I think it was 1987, Lee, where, and this changes each year, you adjust it per inflation based on 1978 numbers. In 1987, the state exceeded the GAN limit. And now with this $40 billion in the bank, it appears that Sacramento is going to exceed the GAN limit. So you think, great, everybody's going to get $1,000. No, if you do the math on this, Lee, it turns out to be more like $170. So all the money you're sending to Sacramento, Lee, you're going to get a check for $170.
Okay.
which when you think about it, is just kind of, it's not just, entry. It's insult upon entry, because you get a check for $1.70. You know, you got to go to the bank and cash the check for $1.70, which means you have to use more than $1.70 in gas to go cash the check. So thank you, California.
Yeah, you know, maybe I'll tape it up to my fireplace mantle as something for guests to come back and look at. And Bill, when you mentioned the state's revenue coffers, should we thank all those one percenters who pay their all those vile one percenters who pay their taxes and made investments?
You're thinking like me today. This is my next question. Just how long can the state maintain the system where you're just riding, you're kind of getting a free lunch off the one percenters? In other words, this incredibly small little sliver of Californians who chip in over half the revenue to Sacramento every year. Because why? Because they make this kind of money through moving capital gain. I mean, is this a sustainable system?
Yeah, it's not sustainable. California has close, you probably know the numbers better than me. I think it's about 47% of tax revenue comes from the top 1%.
Yep.
Compared to about 36% within the country as a whole. So I think for years, both parties understand what the potential costs of this are, which is the enormous volatility that occurs with capital gains. And that, when you really need the tax revenue during downturns, that's when capital gains realizations dry up because the stock market has gone down. So this is a perennial problem in California. And as people are going to be, as those one percenters perhaps establish residency in other states and still do things here, but they no longer have residency here, that's going to be more and more of a problem. So, and when you mentioned, Paul Gann and his efforts to try to fight Leviathan and try to starve the beast,
right?
This has been over 40 years in the making. We've been fighting these wars within the state of California, and you and I and other folks at Hoover have been losing. And just to go back for a moment to the November elections, where I think a lot of people in the Democratic Party were very surprised that undoing Prop 13 for businesses failed, that additional rent control failed, that undoing colorblind admissions to colleges, undoing colorblind hiring for public hiring. They were surprised by that. And why is that? Those bills were not in the best interest of most Californians. So I just, whenever I write one of my California under my columns, when I finish it, I almost always think, my God, when are voters going to come to their senses and understand they are just being taken for a ride?
Right.
That all these organizations that say they have their backs are picking their pockets. That's got to happen sooner or later. When are we going to have that Abraham Lincoln moment about you can't fool all the people all the time? Bill, when am I going to get my Abraham Lincoln moment? I keep thinking it's around the corner. Maybe last fall's election results suggest that maybe it will happen.
With your Sacramento refund, you can get 170 Abraham Lincoln pennies if you'd like. You're third of the way to an Abraham Lincoln $5 bill. But a final note on Paul Gann, then we'll close out the podcast. Part of his legacy is this limit, but also part of his legacy, Lee, is that once this passes and the left in Sacramento realizes, holy smokes, we can't spend it the way we'd like, what comes up next is Proposition 98, which goes on the ballot. Proposition 98, for those not familiar, requires 40% of new revenue to go to education. And this is significantly why this is the birth of teachers unions as a powerful force in Sacramento. So that's part of the negative legacy of Paul Gann, if you will. On one hand, he cared very much about revenue. He cared very much about overspending. On the other hand, though, it leads to the rise of teachers unions in California. So let's close out the podcast, Lee, and not to be blasphemous here, but since this is Good Friday and Easter is approaching, let's talk about a California that's rising, if not rising from the dead, but will be rising this summer. What are you looking for in terms of rebound and renaissance, new birth, if you will?
Yeah. As people are getting vaccinated, and thankfully, my wife and I just got our second Pfizer shot a week ago, so we're very thankful for that. Leisure, hospitality, travel, And coming at summertime, those are going to be areas that really do rebound for California. And I think we all feel very desperately for all those workers who really have been frozen out of being able to have a job, restaurants, entertainment. That's all going to come back very, very strongly for California, certainly in a relative sense. A lot of other people are back at work, but as more and more get vaccine, more and more travel, and all those attendant and ancillary related industries are going to be expanding. And then just to tie that back with Gavin, a reason perhaps for LNE to wait to call a new election is for more good economic numbers to come in, because they will be coming in for California just like they will be for every state. And Gavin will be in front of every TV camera he can find saying, hey, look at me, look how I brought our state back from the brink.
Right, but he's making one big gamble by doing that, Lee, and he is gambling on schools reopening in honesty this fall. Anecdotally talking to friends, colleagues who have kids, private schools are doing fine, but public schools, one colleague has a kid who quote-unquote lost the lottery, the lottery being that only a certain amount of kids could go back to the classroom, so he's still stuck at home. So reopening versus the idea of reopening in earnest, which I would describe as 5 days a week, you know, the way things once were. We'll see if that happens this fall or not. And that's what I'd be worrying about if I were the governor, because I think the potency in that issue.
I know. I mean, I feel for those families. I feel for those children. And then we have Gavin, whose kids have been in private school, as I understand it. And Gavin trying to empathize with people saying, hey, I'm a Zoom parent also.
He got dinged badly. Well, I dinged him on this. So he did a riff in his State of the State address on being a Zoom parent. And then he went on, I think, maybe CNN with Jake Tapper, one of the national. He did a media blitz a couple weeks ago just to get ahead of the recall signatures being turned in. And he lamented the idea of the awfulness of being a Zoom parent. And reporters checked in with the first partner, his wife. She's not a first lady. She's a first partner. And she said words to the effect of, well, basically, things haven't changed with our kids since October when they were in school. So we talk about French laundry. We will close out here in a second. You know, you talk about French laundry as kind of a symbolic, arrogant thing. And I guess maybe it's the word French in there on top of everything else. But the idea of fine dining at the time when you're telling people to stay home and not go outside. But I think it's when, as a politician, you're doing something like that, you're giving the indication that you're something that you're just not. And if you're not a Zoom parent, why pretend to be? And this always fascinates me with politicians, how they will just, put on this kind of facade. So again, I would look at that, Lee, if the, schools should be reopened this fall, but if it's not honest, earnest reopening, I wonder if that comes back to bite the governor.
I agree. That would be devastating for him. Bill, I think a distinguishing feature of the most effective politicians, putting aside, left or right, red or blue, a distinguishing feature is that they really learn from their mistakes. Clinton learned from his mistakes. Reagan learned from his mistakes. You go down the list. Best politicians learn from their mistakes and they grow from it and they become even more effective. And we have Gavin doubling down after the French laundry on his Zoom parent quote. So I hope that doesn't speak volumes about Gavin, but I worry it does.
Okay, Lee, I think that's a good note to end the conversation. Enjoyed our little talk, and hey, go Bruins.
Thanks, Bill. Always good to share time with you, my friend.
Okay, thanks, Lee. I enjoyed it. You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. In today's case, California. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Lee Ohanian, brave man that he is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Lee_Ohanian. Let me repeat that, @Lee_Ohanian. Ohanian spelled O-H-A-N-I-A-N. I mentioned our website at the beginning of the broadcast. That is www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Leah Ohanian and his Hoover colleagues. Very simple to sign up. You just go to the Publications tab, type on Hoover Publications, then go to Daily Report. You'll also see California On Your Mind as well, where Leah Ohanian and I write almost every week on matters of public policy and politics here in the Golden State. So sign up for that too. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. As always, thanks for listening. Take care.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.